history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. When you take the time to listen to their stories, you never know what you're going to hear. I am continually amazed by their stories, and boy, are we going to hear some doozies in the weeks ahead. Do an internet search for the Old Bold Pilots or the Candy Bomber, and you'll get a sneak peek into what's coming up in our next few episodes. The idea behind the show is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we really learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. My plan was to bring you Gail Halvorsen's story today. He is known around the world, and especially in Germany, as the Candy Bomber because of a simple act of compassion and care during the Berlin airlift that grew into quite the phenomenon. I'm going to ask you to wait until next time for his one-of-a-kind story, because when I heard of the passing of Monty Irvin at the age of 96, I thought we really need to honor his legacy and bring you his life story in his words today. It's an interview recorded back in 2010. Hometown Heroes only aired on one radio station back then, so almost all of you listening on all of our different Hometown Heroes affiliates today haven't had the chance to hear this gentleman. And perhaps no word describes Monty Irvin better than that one, gentleman. He might not be as well known as some of the other stars of his era, but he was just as amazing a ball player, and just like his fellow baseball Hall of Famers like Yogi Berra, Ted Williams, Jackie Robinson, Bob Feller, Monty Irvin served in our armed forces during World War II. In fact, if you listen closely, I think you'll hear him suggest that the way he and Robinson and thousands of other African-American soldiers proved their mettle and proved their patriotism in a segregated military during the war created the momentum to knock down baseball's color barrier. I think you'll also hear heartfelt humility, and you'll get a taste of why Willie Mays called Monty Irvin, quote, someone who was like a second father to me. At the time this interview was recorded in 2010, the San Francisco Giants hadn't won a World Series since Irvin and Mays led them to the title in 1954. That topic's going to come up a little later, but here is that conversation with the one and only Monty Irvin, who joined the program via telephone from his home in Houston, Texas.
Mr. Irvin, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Paul.
Now, you started playing ball pretty early, and you talk about family. You're from a pretty big family. You're the third youngest of 11 children?
Oh, we were 13.
13 children?
Yeah, I had six sisters and six brothers.
Well, how much of your athletic prowess do you think can be traced back to chasing your big brothers around?
Well, we all got started because my father was a great baseball fan. And then I had a brother about 10 years older than me. His name was Bob. He was a pitcher, threw as hard as anybody. Well, I remember a team came through one year, and they saw him pitch, and they wanted to sign him. Of course, he was living at home. He went and said, Mom, he said, there's a team interested in my playing with him. Is it okay? She said, yeah, it's okay, as long as they don't play on Sunday. So he said, Mom, Sunday is their biggest day. She said, no, if they play on Sunday, you can't go because it's a sin to play baseball on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, later on he got married, of course, and 10 years later I came along, and by then she had changed her mind, and she encouraged us to play and get as good as we could be. Consequently, I had a brother, my brother in North Carolina, Cal Irvin. He became a great shortstop, but he, you know, at that time, the money in the Negro League wasn't very much, so he said, well, since I don't have your power, I think I better go on to college and get a degree and start to teach and coach, and that's what he did. He was an athletic director at A&T College in Greensboro, North Carolina, and my other brother went to Virginia State. He was a football player, so there's a lot of athleticism, you know, in my family.
No question.
And I still have some nieces and nephews that are playing today.
I believe it. And, mm-hmm. and I'm sure if someone put a bat in your hand, you wouldn't be afraid to take a whack either.
I could show them how to do it.
We're talking to Baseball Hall of Famer.
Except my head can't run.
Monty Irvin, Baseball Hall of Famer. You were born in Alabama, moved to New Jersey at a young age, but I guess your time in the South still gave you a taste of an ugly part of our history. How big of a difference was it for you to move north of the Mason-Dixon line and grow up in New Jersey?
The biggest thing is, the greatest thing my father ever did was to get us out of there, because my older brothers and sisters had very little education, even though they went to school after we got to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But when we moved there, my father, stressed on the importance of education. So four of us went to, got a chance to go to college. And that was a blessing. We're still grateful to him for making that big move.
Now, you've been voted by one publication the greatest athlete ever in New Jersey. And I understand at East Orange High, you start in football, basketball, baseball, and track. You set a state record in the javelin, too?
Yeah, in track. I was track. But it wasn't East Orange, it was Orange.
Orange? Oh, is that a rival?
Oranges. Orange, East Orange, West Orange, and South Orange. We lived right in Orange. Later on, I moved to East Orange, but we started in Orange.
Now, I also heard that during this time, as a teenager and starting to star in these different athletic pursuits, you had to overcome a near-fatal illness. What was that all about?
Yeah, I had a streptococcal infection. I got a scratch on my finger playing basketball, infection settled in my chest, and I had this wonderful surgeon who found it and operated on me and saved my life. I was so grateful to him. We remained close friends, good friends, until he passed on. But if he hadn't, I was close to death pretty quick. But he found the infection and gave me about three operations, and I got okay. And then that was in February of 1938. And so I had gotten a scholarship to Michigan, University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't think I was going to get well. But not only did I get well, but I recovered and got stronger than I was before. So it didn't deter my football, my athleticism, when I went to Lincoln University in Oxford, PA.
Yeah, sounds like somebody had a better plan for you.
Yeah, that's true.
And you mentioned Lincoln College in Oxford, PA. And you were there and enrolled and competing for them. But at the same time, under a different name, and this really intrigues me, you decided that you were going to be Jimmy Nelson and play for the Newark Eagles in the Negro Leagues. How'd you pull that off?
Well, communications then wasn't what it is now, and you could do it and get away with it. I remember Jim Thorpe and some other guys did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In order to, we're still in the Depression at that time, and there was very little money. So I went on, in the summer, I would I'd play with the Eagles. I wouldn't play at home. When we went on the road, I'd play. When we got home, I'd work out with the team and then go sit on the in the stand. But it gave me a chance to help out with finances. And then, of course, I only went to Lincoln a year and a half. And because of financial problems, I stopped going to Lincoln and spent full time with the Newark Eagles.
And obviously,
that was in 1939.
And you were clearly at the top of your game. You won a couple of Negro League batting titles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, as we think back in the history of the Negro Leagues and some of the great ball players, maybe I can throw out a name and you could give me some quick thoughts about your observations of that player.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with Josh Gibson, was he really the greatest hitter ever?
Greatest hitter I've ever seen. I'm not taking anything away from Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams and Mickey Mantle and all those other great hitters, Barry Bonds and so on. But this man was a natural. I've never seen a swing the kind that he had. He was strong as two men, about 6'1", around 210, had a rifle for an arm, but he could hit. He could hit, he could run, and he could throw. And every league he ever played in, he won the home run championship and the batting championship. Not only was he a great hitter, but a home run hitter, but he hit for high average. He was something to behold.
Now, another name, and I won't go all the way through the list, but the guy I'm sure that you had to face, Satchel Paige. What made him so special?
Because he could throw the ball so hard and he had such great control. Plus, he was fearless. He didn't fear anybody. If he said he was going to get you out, he'd get you out. He threw the ball very fast and had great control, and he could almost strike you out when he wanted to. He was something else.
Now,
one of the best pitchers I've ever faced.
And I want to get on with where your story went from there, but before we move on from the Negro League ball players, was there someone, we've heard those famous names like Gibson and Page and Cool Papa Bell. And
Buck Leonard.
Is there someone
John
that
Henry
maybe,
Lloyd.
You think there's someone that maybe doesn't get enough attention that you thought was really special?
Oh, yeah, there's a, of course, you know, here of late, they put, you know, about 17 guys in about 3 years ago. And his name was Bill Wright, of course. And he was an outfielder, can run like a deer, and good hitter, good fielder, good everything. And then there was a relief pitcher. His name was Webster McDonald, and he lived in Philadelphia. He was a submarine pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And if you saw him, you never would forget him. He made it a habit of beating the major leaguers when they, you know, when they barnstorm.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, they just put Dick Lundy was a great shortstop. He's in the mold of you know, Willie Wells and John Henry Lloyd. He was just a wonderful person, a great hitter, great fielder, and just a great guy. When he stopped playing, he managed. He was my first manager when I went to with the Newark Eagles.
You know, and we talk about, you mentioned barnstorming, and that's, in those situations, you guys got a chance to see how you stacked up against these major leaguers, mm-hmm. and obviously knew you could compete. How
yep.
hard and how frustrating was it for you to realize that you didn't have access to that league?
Well, we were disappointed, and we made some friends with some of the major leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team, and they played each other. They broke about even, but it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts out there looking for talent signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand, with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true. Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field. So I want to, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around with his follow through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did, and by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Yeah, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance and the fact that, you know, you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball and see the ball and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. Later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you.
And guess
too.
What? Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
Two Hall of Famers, not too proud to borrow from another. We're not done talking about Willie Mays. What did he say to Monty Irvin after his famous basket catch in the 1954 World Series? We'll also revisit another legendary moment that Irvin was there for, and we'll explore his time in the Army in World War II. Monty Irvin passed away January 11th at the age of 96, but one of the missions of this program is to preserve the stories of our veterans so their voices live on, even after they're no longer with us. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.